Thank you, Oscar, for this initiative and for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be part of this event and this forthcoming network, which I think we all look forward to hearing more about. I'm very excited to be here and to contribute to the discussion that will be developed over the coming days. The contribution that I will be making to this event is based on a collaborative research project that I coordinated together with several other colleagues. The project began in 2017 and it empirically examined junk viral news, political memes, trolling practices, and their social lives online. And these were studied, we studied this in the context of the 2016 U.S. presidential elections and also in the context of the French and Dutch elections of the following year. But in this talk, I'll focus mainly on the work around junk political stories that had gone viral around the 2016 U.S. elections. Yes, so the collaborations around this project resulted in a series of publications, one of which is forthcoming in a special issue in New Media and Society, which Oscar is co-editing. And the contribution we have sought to make through this work was generally to shift attention from questions of bad content, malicious sources, and undiscerning users to the socio-technical infrastructures that enable the spread of junk news. Thank you. So this particular interest was prompted by what we perceived to be some of the main ways in which the problem of junk news is framed, as well as prominent responses that have emerged to address this phenomenon. So, as we all know, the junk news and online manipulation scandal prompted extensive mobilization from governments in the US and Europe, and also from civil society, the news media, and technology companies. So we have seen everything from congressional and parliamentary inquiries to the development of fact-checking tools to evaluate the truth value of these statements, technological solutions to flag problematic sources on social media, and media literacy initiatives to help users better evaluate information sources online. And when looking at some of these many responses, two frames seem prominent. The first is a treatment of fake news as an issue of problematic content or problematic sources which need to be eliminated. So bad sources, whether politically or economically motivated, so-called scammers looking to make a quick buck, as one New York Times editorial describes them, are approached with blacklisting, social media flagging, and fact-checking. The second frame that can be read in some of these responses is that of bad or deficient users. So in relation to junk news, the public is often described as suffering from various deficiencies. And these deficiencies range from gullibility to short attention spans and inability or unwillingness to discern good from bad content. And media literacy solutions are often designed to address these deficiencies. And one of my favorite examples of the user's deficiencies frame is this speculative proposal for introducing a gullible tag to label social media users who fall for misleading content. And this, incidentally, might also be very interesting to advertisers on the platform. So underlying many of these responses to fake news, which frame the issue as a bad content problem or as a bad user problem, and the solutions as correcting bad content and educating naive users, media researchers will recognize a common model of communication. And this is known as the transmission model, which James Carey speaks about in this 1989 collection of essays. So in this view, news, be it real or fake, is a process of disseminating or transmitting information to achieve particular effects on audiences. So, for example, to enlighten or entertain them and to consolidate or change their beliefs. Science and technology studies researchers will recognize in these discussions what in science and technology studies is known as the knowledge deficit model. This model suggests that when the public does not seem to accept or understand science, we are dealing with a problem of communication or education. So the solution in this model will always be to provide more of the true facts. But there are a number of ways in which these models leave out important aspects and may lead to problems. For example, the transmission model of communication leaves out the way in which digital content units are also cultural forms. They are ways of representing and performing social identities, shared beliefs, values, and views of the world. And the information deficit model was also shown to be limited. And this is because the willingness of the public to accept a piece of information, be it science or news, true or false, is not just an intellectual or a cognitive process. It is a social process where trust, credibility, social identities, and relationships between the parties involved are at stake. And finally, these solutions also leave unaccounted digital infrastructures and their role in the way content circulates and gains prominence online. So, while all these interventions are important, the phenomenon of fake news problematizes not only what is said, but also the very conditions of sayability. That is, the digital infrastructures that mediate the circulation of online content. And colleagues and I propose the notion of infrastructural uncanny to refer to the uncertainties, anxieties, and questions that emerge in relation to how digital infrastructures, social platforms, and other online devices participate in opinion manipulation, junk content farming and circulation, and also in collective life more generally. Yeah, and here we use the notion of digital infrastructures to refer to the various socio-technical arrangements involved in online content production, distribution, and monetization. So, for example, platforms like YouTube and Facebook. So, in a different context, media theorist and historian Bernard Gagan defines the infrastructural uncanny as a range of unsettling phenomena that tend to emerge in periods of rapid expansion in the means of technological conveyance. As science and technology studies researchers remind us, while present in many aspects of our lives, infrastructures, be they digital or not, tend to remain invisible to us unless they break down. Infrastructures tend to become visible when they stop working or when they don't work according to our needs and expectations. But what we think is concerning in the fake news and online manipulation scandal is not the failure of online infrastructures, but precisely their uncanny success in facilitating the spread of false and misleading content. So, fake news can be seen as a concern deriving from the unexpected success in enlisting familiar infrastructures in the service of unanticipated projects, that is, the circulation, engagement, and monetization of deceptive content. In other words, the viral spread of junk news may be seen not as a failure or an anomaly, but as a feature of these infrastructures. And as sociologist Norce Maris kind of provocatively puts it, social media are a truthless public sphere by design. And to cite Maris, lack of respect for facts in online discourse has deep and complex causes which go well beyond the qualities of information sources and users on the internet. Instead, they have to do with the very designs of digital infrastructures and how these operate on conditions for public knowledge. So according to Morris, scientific models that inform the design of social media platforms adapted from behavioral science, but also from physics and biology. So to take just an example, the communication as viral contagion model, configure users as primarily manipulable and influenceable subjects and not as knowledge agents in order to encourage shareability and viral spread of content. Related to our notion of infrastructural uncanny is another beautiful expression of a new media scholar, Wendy Chun, that talks about the creepiness of new media. And this is to draw attention to how new media matter, not just when they are disruptive, but maybe even more when they become habitual and banal. And it is on this background of new media becoming habitual and banal that digital infrastructures have the potential to invoke the uncanny in particular configurations, such as in the case of junk news. So it is in these cases that the very same platforms and infrastructures which have been celebrated in relation to the democratization of access to content and the means to distribute it, that are now seen as agents of what has been called information disorder. The infrastructural uncanny manifests when the role of socio-technical devices in the co-production of value, engagement, audience, and social relations becomes unsettling and generates ambiguities about how agency is distributed. So, for example, infrastructures for metrifying engagement might make it unclear whether likes or posts of junk news are the result of bots, algorithms, paid propagandists, remote entrepreneurs, or grassroots political activists. So in our work, we took the infrastructural uncanny as an occasion for examining the social life of junk viral news online and the role of various digital devices and platforms in shaping this phenomenon. And in the remaining time, I will present a few examples from our empirical work, which take the shape of what we called infrastructural scenographies. And our notion of infrastructural scenographies draws on Bruno Latour's notion of scenographies, which signals a shift from standalone matters of fact to their conditions of production. And we propose methodological tactics for exploring the ways in which digital infrastructures participate in the co-articulation of junk news and our ways of knowing it through the ranking of content, metrification of participation, and commodification of attention. Our scenographies highlight how banal and habitual infrastructures, which have been adopted as methods for organizing and accounting for social lives more generally, play out in the context of junk content farming and circulation. And these infrastructural scenographies or empirical studies are part of a field guide to fake news and other information disorders. And one of the presenters tomorrow, also Anders Munk, also contributed to this work. These infrastructural scenographies and the concept of the infrastructural uncanny are further developed in the article that I mentioned earlier, and I would be happy to circulate a preprint if Oscar allows it ahead of publication. And so as far as the field guide is concerned, the field guide explores junk viral news, political memes, trolling practices, and their social lives online. And by social lives online, it is meant the ways in which they shape and are shaped by the socio-technical configurations online. The guide, which has also been translated into Chinese and Japanese, is designed as a collection of methodological recipes and evaluative procedures which journalists, researchers, and students can use and adapt to their own investigations. And that is why the recipes, as we call them, are accompanied by methods maps, such as the one on this slide, to facilitate navigation of the research design. And I'll try to go through three examples. And these take up the articulation of junk news through public Facebook pages, search engine rankings, and third-party web tracking infrastructures. So our first study pertains to how search engines organize online content, and particularly what we can learn from search engine rankings about the circulation and referencing dynamics of junk news stories on the web. Because of their role in ordering and ranking content, search engines can be viewed, according to New Media scholar Richard Rogers, as epistemological machines and as a potential collision space for alternative accounts of reality. Our first study started with the uncanny, prompted by the appearance of unwanted false news in the top of Google search results, where one would typically expect authoritative news sources to appear. And this was the week after the 2016 U.S. elections, when several outlets reported that queries such as final election results returned a story from the junk news site 70 News. And this story suggested that Trump, rather than Clinton, had won the popular vote. This may be taken as another case of infrastructural uncanny, in the sense that it is not the story itself that surprises us. After all, deception, rumors, conspiracy, and ignorance have always been significant components of social life and culture. But what surprises us is its positioning at the top of Google results, where we would expect established news sources to be listed. And in relation to junk news and misinformation, Google has been criticized both for not taking enough action, as in the case of this story emerging at the top of results, but also for taking too much action in their attempts to take it down. And in the study, we took search engine rankings as a research object and analytical technique to examine search engine narratives about junk news circulation. And I will illustrate this analysis with just one of the stories that we analyzed, the famous Pope endorses Trump story. So what we found was that 5 months after the U.S. elections, top Google search rankings provided the account of the response to fake news via debunking and fact-checking. So on the informational web, organized by the search engine, where hyperlinks are used as a measure of authority, the story's falsehood was accepted, and established sources appear to retain their authority. So the network, exploring who mentions whom in relation to the story, based on citation analysis between the websites that that show up in the top Google results, shows a strong presence of established sources. Those are the green nodes, such as mainstream media organizations and fact-checking initiatives. Yeah, and most sources cite the story in order to debunk it. But despite efforts from these initiatives to not link to junk news sources so as not to boost their ranking, junk news sources are still present at the top of search engine results through the referencing practices of websites that report to them. So the junk news sources are the ones depicted in orange. A similar finding is made in another hyperlink study by colleagues and myself, and this is a study of linking patterns between sources in the French media ecosystem. And to demarcate this ecosystem, we used a database of sources of various degrees of reliability, so reliable, imprecise, satirical, and so on, compiled by the French fact-checking initiative Le Decodeur. And this analysis showed that reliable sources are cited by all types of websites in the ecosystem, while unreliable sources are only cited by a few other types. So all websites, no matter how disreputable, tend to link up to more reliable websites, such as news websites. So these two examples show that in spite of the proliferation of fabricated content of various shades, reputation hierarchies on the informational web, as seen through linking patterns, seem to be maintained, at least to some extent, as fake and hyper-partisan sites deploy aspirational hyperlinking styles that favor, at least surprisingly to us, authoritative sources. But as we'll see in the next example, the story is very different from when we move from the informational web to the social web organized by Facebook. And as a brief methodological note on how search engine rankings can be repurposed to trace the circulation of junk news on the web from the viewpoint of the search engine. So to do this analysis, we used Google web search results with a depersonalized research browser. We captured all the available instances of a fake news story in the top 100 results. And we did this 4 months after the election in March 2017. And for all instances that we found in the top 100 results, we collected their URLs and various metadata, the date of publication of the web page, whether they advocate or debunk the false story, the sources that they reference, and how the citation is done, if it's done with a hyperlink or just with a mention to the title of the junk news site. And we did a number of analyses, as I briefly went through. And the methodological issue that we encountered here, and also one of the interesting things that we found, was that fact-checkers adapted their practices to not link to junk news sites so as not to boost them in the rankings. So originally, we wanted to map links between sites returned in the top Google results for the story in order to understand associations through linking. But we ended up adapting hyperlink mapping to a mapping of referencing patterns, either textual or as links, to capture this ghostly presence of junk news sites in the pages returned in top search engine results, not as links, but just as names. In another empirical study, we examined how junk news is articulated through the sharing of viral stories on public Facebook pages. This sharing activity has been a source of anxiety in a number of ways. A famous BuzzFeed News article raised concerns about junk content appearing to overtake or outperform real content on Facebook in terms of engagement. And there are also, of course, a lot of ambiguities about the forms of distributed agency involved in the construction of engagement. So are we dealing with authentic or fake engagement, with bots, paid users, fake likes, and so on? The focus of our study was to provide a different perspective to aggregated metrics and engagement scores by qualitatively looking at which pages and groups share junk news stories and how much, as well as what these groups were about. So we qualitatively examined the public pages that circulated a set of over 20 junk viral stories about the U.S. elections. We identified the public pages that most prominently shared these items with a digital analytics tool called CrowdTangle, and we manually categorized them based on their self-descriptions, and we were also interested in how page users make meaning around that these items, but that worked less well because Facebook, of course, had already blocked those pages and removed those items, which is a big issue in research around these topics. So, while the stories were about elections, what we found was that the groups that shared them were not just about electoral politics, but also about a wide range of other topics and issues, such as entertainment, clickbait, cultural institutions, and music. Yeah, so persuasion and deception were not the only purposes that the sharing of these stories served. They also acted as monetizable clickbait for pages that make money out of any kind of viral content, no matter whether the topic is political or not, and provided humor for entertainment groups. So, in contrast to aggregated engagement metrics, page-level and group-level views show how junk news serves to gather and mobilize audiences for a variety of purposes. So again, not just to persuade. As fact-checking has been positioned as one of the major responses to junk news, we also examined whether debunking content is acknowledged by the pages and groups that share the junk stories. And what we saw was that fact-check corrections are rarely acknowledged by the communities where false news circulates. False news stories and fact-checked versions of them actually circulate in very different communities. And what this graphic shows is that only 6 of the over 300 pages in our study that shared junk news stories had acknowledged the debunked versions of these stories. Yeah, so in this graphic, each group of bubbles represents a set of pages that share a story, and they are sized. The circles are sized by the number of interactions and colored by whether they share the original story or the fact-check version of it. And the very few titles of pages in red are the names of pages which share both versions of the story. Yeah, so this again invites the question, and fact-checking has been critiqued quite a bit in a number of different ways, and this again invites the question of the capacity of fact-checking to meaningfully engage the audiences of junk news online, or whether fact-checking brings its own audiences into being. So it definitely does something, but the question is who it addresses and how. The final study pertains to the tracking infrastructures of junk content farming and the distributed construction and exchange of its user attention commodity. The junk viral news scandal again problematized not just platforms and search engines, but also web economies and digital content monetization practices. Media reports highlighted that the economic success of viral news and viral content farming is based on a combination of low-cost, clickbaity content production with what in advertising is known as click arbitrage. So click arbitrage involves buying website traffic cheaply through advertising on platforms such as Facebook, and then these audiences are then brought onto the site where ad revenue can be made through ad networks such as Google AdSense. And debates about the economics of fake news have so far focused on sanctioning disreputable publishers by blacklisting them from ad networks and flagging their content on Facebook. But in this study, we wanted to extend the frame from individual services to be blamed to the scale, composition, and character of the networks involved in capturing, measuring, calculating, and monetizing audiences. These activities and exchanges are known as what Philip Napoli calls the online audience marketplace, or what others call the marketplace of attention. The methodological tactic that we proposed in the scenography was to repurpose the third-party web tracking infrastructures of both high-quality and junk content sites. So both professional news and junk news. And the aim was to explore the online audience marketplaces that underpin successful viral content. These marketplaces, in the context of advertising-supported digital cultural production, have become very complex. Exchanges and connections between the supply and demand side of advertising inventory are increasingly handled programmatically. They are mediated by a large number of interdependent intermediaries, including ad networks, ad exchanges, data brokers, and big online platforms. These complex marketplaces are enabled by the stabilization of what new media researchers Carolyn Gerlitz and Anne Helmont call an invisible data mining infrastructure that enables various aspects of user behavior to be tracked inside and across the web by establishing data flows between websites and various third-party services. And this is done through third-party web trackers. So these are small bits of third-party code embedded in these websites in order to collect various kinds of user data, to monitor engagement, including visitor numbers, visiting browsing behavior on the web, and the effectiveness of ads. So you can think of everything from social media buttons to site analytics and ad delivery. Of course, third-party web tracking serves not just advertising, but a variety of different functions. And of course, methods other than web tracking are used in audience marketplaces. But in this study, we focused on web tracking as online audience marketplace devices. And here, we draw on Michel Callot and Fabien Muniesa's notion of market device to draw attention to the work that web tracking does to materialize relations, exchanges, and data flows between different participants in these markets. So to do this analysis, we used a BuzzFeed News corpus of 19 US-based mainstream news sites and 19 junk content sites and identified third-party tracking devices embedded in the most successful content of these sites. And then we qualitatively analyzed the composition of tracking networks in which both junk news and professional news sites are embedded. And there are several insights that we can take from this analysis. And yes, this might not be clear, but I will explain because there is a lot of work that goes in interpreting network diagrams. But I will explain some of the insights that can be taken from this analysis. And the first is that adding audience marketplace configurations to the scenographies of junk content farming and circulation redoes the spatiality of the fake news problem. So the focus shifts from Macedonian, Romanian, or Russian towns right back to the backyards of countries where these concerns arise. Such an analysis reconfigures the problem as not just one of localized, bad quality, or malicious content producers, but rather as one of transnational online audience marketplaces. And these marketplaces are link what Norce Maris calls with irony and disciplined youth from out of town with the homegrown online advertising and marketing industries located mainly in the US, UK, and a few other Western European countries. The second insight that we can take from this analysis is that mainstream news websites appear to be both more intrusive and more diverse in their tracking practices than junk news sites. Professional news sites connect to a larger number of unique tracking elements than junk news sites and also send more connections to these. And this insight raises concerns about the privacy of the users navigating professional news sites. But at the same time, it can also be taken as an indication of the fragility of business models and revenue streams of advertising-supported news media increasingly pressured to monetize all their inventory. The third insight pertains to the audience marketplace configurations of digital cultural production more broadly. And given that we started in this analysis with two types of digital cultural production, so professional news and junk content sites, we might expect a clearer division in the network in this graphic into two equally sized regions, that of junk on the one hand and high quality content producers on the other. But that is obviously not the case. And examining densities of nodes enables us to interpret multiple regions in this graphic. Analyzing the nature and volume of actors composing each major region in the network gestures towards a spectrum of marketplace configurations. At one end of the spectrum, and the largest region of in the graph, the one in blue, we can construe a professionalized configuration associated with high-quality publishers. Audience construction and monetization in this region is distributed, diversified, and intensified through scores of advertising industry intermediaries. So in this region, we encounter major ad exchanges such as DoubleClick, but we also encounter multiple demand-side platforms used by advertisers and advertising agencies to automate the buying of targeted inventory from a number of sources. And we also find supply-side platforms used by publishers to automate the sale of residual inventory, which could not be sold directly to advertisers. And alongside these, we also recognize several data brokers and data aggregators specializing in collecting, combining, and selling audience data. And these data sets help to enhance the audience commodity sold to advertisers. At the other end of the spectrum, the region in pink at the top of the graph, we find what could be construed as an amateur audience marketplace configuration specific to the long tail of the internet and to small-scale amateur-run publishing operations. And this includes a large proportion of the junk websites in our corpus. And in this space, audience monetization relies on fewer intermediary data and advertising services and is prominently performed through services that have emerged to monetize user-generated content or the long tail of the internet. And these are, of course, ad networks and ad exchanges such as Google AdSense, Site Scout, AdScale, and so on. Yeah, so this configuration is more moderate in tracking and also heavily reliant on social media to attract traffic and on ad networks to monetize it. Finally, asymmetries between participants in the audience marketplace cut across all these configurations. So notable are, of course, the monopolistic tendencies resulting from the platformization or extension of big U.S.-based online platforms such as Google, Twitter, and Facebook in the space of audience measurement and monetization. Notable is also the asymmetry between digital content producers and the digital advertising industry, illustrated by the scale at which digital content producers, particularly high-quality ones, have become vehicles for intrusive digital advertising and data industry tracking and data collection practices. Yeah, so over two-thirds of all the tracking elements in our study were advertising related. And finally, regulations such as the GDPR are aimed at increasing transparency and accountability on the audience and data collector or processor side of the advertising market. But the relations between publishers and advertisers and the pressure that the business practices of the online advertising and digital marketing industries place on publishers would also need to be attended to if aggressive online data collection practices and privacy invasion are to be tempered. And with this, I should stop here. So that was the final example. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hello. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Edson. I'm from NTU in Singapore. It's my first time to experience a 10 p.m. sunset. It's my first time in this area. Also, first time to have a very expensive McDonald's burger. But I'm glad to be here. I'm very grateful to Oscar and Steen and at Oslo Metropolitan University for organizing this event and for inviting me. Liliana, I've been trying to meet with her team in September, so I'm so glad that she's here. And she had a very comprehensive, wonderful presentation, so I think I will not present this afternoon. I will just leave it at that. So my presentation, our focus, and at least the projects I've been part of in Singapore at NTU, some of the projects I'll be talking about actually come from a collaboration with a team in Singapore. Rich Ling is here. I'm part of one of his research groups. So some of the data that I'll be sharing will be coming from that group. In response to Steen's comment earlier, this is now when we blame the individuals, you know, which maybe some of us enjoy here, you know, blaming the individuals. So our focus is on audiences and what makes them vulnerable to believing in forms of disinformation. So, my introduction slide is, you know, so post 2016, we've come into this type of definition of what fake news is, right? It's a form of intentional disinformation that derives its potency from trying to look like real news. But the term fake news is not really new. Before 2016, scholars have used it to refer to different things, such as propaganda or parody sites. You know, when Jon Stewart became famous with the Daily Show, we've also used it to refer to satirical programs. So we've used it in a number of different ways, and political actors have also since misused it and weaponized it to refer to journalists that they do not like. But on behalf of the teenagers in Macedonia and those who run the troll farms and click farms in Philippines, I'd like to make a case for retaining the use of the term fake news, because I will argue that it has some theoretical utility. At least in the work that I'm doing, I still refer to fake news, and I refer to a very specific form of disinformation. So we categorize fake news as an instance of disinformation. So the larger category is disinformation, and fake news is one type of disinformation. So there are several elements that comprise fake news. First one is there is the intention to deceive. So we park it under disinformation, which is a type of misinformation that is intentional. So it's not wrong journalism, but it's something that's intentionally designed to mislead people. But there's also the level of facticity. And, you know, when we've used the term fake news to refer to satirical programs, the facticity isn't really there, right? Because satirical programs are still based on real events, but the fakeness comes from trying to look like news. So it's not really a news program. It tries to look like a news program, but it still includes facts, but it's delivered in a very humoristic way. But fake news that we see now is they're very low in facticity, so they're false, right? But I think the main element is them trying to look like news. So they're deriving their potency, they're quite effective because they're able to mislead people by trying to get on the format, on the look, and the feel of what real news is like. And for a journalism studies person and a former journalist like I am, for me that is particularly important, that we recognize that fake news is powerful because it derives some of its power from things that we've associated with real news. So that's my working definition. And why does it matter? We have seen tangible effects of fake news across different countries, be it in India or in Mexico, in France, in the U.S., even in the Philippines where I'm from, or in Singapore where I'm working now. The studies I'm part of focus on Singapore. It's a very small country, in Southeast Asia, but also the government has been very proactive in trying to do something with fake news. So earlier last year, they created a select committee to investigate the problem. The committee, the top-level ministerial committee, ran several public hearings. And in May, just last month, this year, they finally passed a law to address fake news. So the law allows ministers to order takedowns or corrections to falsehoods that are deemed to be to affect public interest. So a minister can order internet service providers or social media companies or individuals who've shared fake news to issue a correction, or if needed, to actually take down that content. The law also allows, of course, parties to contest that order and to go to the court. But it's a controversial law. Some people say it's quite restrictive. Others believe that it's needed, and it's Singapore trying to be proactive. The ministers have been very vocal that the target for the law is not the individual, but internet service providers, and making sure that social media companies do not provide the financial infrastructure for fake news producers to thrive. So one project that I'm part of, and the one that Rich is leading, looks at the diffusion of PPIDs, what we call portable and personable information devices. And in the first survey that we did, we asked one question, how often do people come across false news? And so we saw that over from between 2016 and 2017, when we did a two-part survey, we found that there's a slight increase. So fake news is quite a very important buzzword in Singapore. So I did a Google search looking at how often people search about this term, so you can compare across different countries. And Singapore, despite its size, it's very small, it ranks second in terms of the countries that search this search term all the time. So the top one, I think, was Philippines, which is my home country. And I'm working in Singapore now. And the third country is the U.S., where I did my PhD, so quite interesting. And so it's a small country. Currently, the examples of fake news that we see that spread on WhatsApp, which is a messaging app, are usually related to consumer affairs or health-related issues. We don't see a lot of political fake news, unlike what we see in countries like the U.S., but we see a lot of consumer-related ones. I think the concern is that at some point, given Singapore's strategic, economic, even geographic location, that it might be a good target for some external actors to attack when it comes to disinformation warfare. And I think that's the reason why the government is trying to be proactive. Oops. Okay. One sec. So another project that I was part of did a comparative survey of college students across four different cities in Asia. So we looked at Shanghai, Taipei, Hong Kong, and Singapore. And we see there that, again, Singapore and China rank high in terms of how frequently people think their friends get exposed to fake news. So, and again, these are only part of the problem, right? Because in both the previous slide and this slide, we only asked people to recall instances when they were successful, or at least they were successful to perceive that their friends got exposed to fake news, right? But the power of fake news is when people, up until this time, believed that what they saw was real, right? So again, these are inherent weaknesses of the method that we used. For me, one thing that's interesting is when I did a small experiment with our own students from the communication school at NTU, and again, these are very smart students, they're very driven, and we try to train them to be very good communicators. So I did an experiment, and I showed them one fake news article, another one is real. Can you tell which of these two is fake or real? Is it the New York one or the Bali story? So both on the same topic, right? But one of these two articles is real. It actually happened. Who says Bali? Okay, Scott says Bali. Who says it? New York one? It's tough, right? And our students actually can't tell. And again, we do our best to train them to be good communicators, right? So these are supposedly, you know, more tech media savvy students. And yet when we show them the fake story, so this is the fake story, 41.8% thought it was real. And then when they saw the real story, almost half couldn't tell. They weren't sure. So again, even with media savvy, tech savvy people, it's really not straightforward. And even I remember one experiment from Stanford when they also did this with I think college students or even younger students. The same findings were there that people can't really tell. It's difficult to tell. And for, again, as a journalism studies person, my concern is how does this impact the entire ecosystem of information, right? As a former journalist, the worry is that at some point, if we see too many fake news, then it just drives down trust across all different institutions, including journalism. So in the same experiment, I also I debrief people. I show them fake or real story, and then asking them a bunch of other questions, I ask them to rate media credibility in general. And before the experiment, I also had a baseline ratings for credibility from the same set of people. And what we see is if they were exposed to the real story, and I tell them after that what you saw was real, the change in perceived media credibility is not significant. This is actually quite the same. But if I tell them that what they saw was false, you see that there is a decrease in media perceived media credibility, and that is significant. And there are two other things that I varied here, whether the Facebook post came from a real news publication, Straits Times, or from a fake news site that I created, and whether the post was shared by a real person or was shared by someone with no profile picture. But those manipulations didn't even work. So it didn't matter who shared it. It didn't matter if a real news site shared a fake story or a fake site shared a real story. As long as you, at least based on the experiment, if you tell them that what they read is false, it might bring down trust in information sources in general. So for me, that is quite worrying, is that we keep on showing them fake stories, we keep on correcting them, but the trust on information institutions might be going down as an effect. So I think that's why it's important to look at what factors contribute to this problem, what makes people believe in fake stories. And so a useful theoretical framework that I use to just guide my studies, help me identify what are the different studies that need to be done, is the SMCR model. So it's a very linear model, right? Basic model of interpersonal communication with information originating from a sender. You have a message, you have a channel and a receiver. So I'm using that as a heuristic to organize the different studies that we're running at NTU. So in terms of source, we're looking at whether the source is credible or familiar. And again, on social media, the idea of a source has been very unclear, right? Is it Straits Times? Is it New York Times? Or is it the friend that shared the link to Straits Times, right? And studies have found that whoever we perceive as the proximate source, the source that's closer to us, affects how we process that message. So it might be from a less credible source, but if it's shared by your mom, like who gave you everything and of course very credible, then how you deal with that information might be different. Right, there might be a strong effect of the proximate source on how much you believe in that information. And then we also, been involved in a couple of studies that also look at the message. So we did a content analysis of articles from fake news sites. We also did a preliminary analysis of pieces of information that gets forwarded on WhatsApp. So WhatsApp is used by 80% of people in Singapore. So it's the main messaging service, no longer SMS. And so we're collecting as many examples as we can of what people share on WhatsApp, and we're looking at patterns across these different types of messages. And then we've looked at channel. We're doing experiments comparing whether a closed messaging app like WhatsApp works differently compared with an open social media site such as Facebook, you know, when people can see what others post versus whether the sharing of information occurs in a very close space. We've also looked at audiences, the receivers, through a series of experiments. And one thing I will share later is our discussions on the role of context, which we haven't tested empirically, but we might have ideas to discuss in a while. So, again, I think it's important to highlight the important role of social media. So social media has changed so many things, even the way journalists do their work, and also the way people consume their news. So this is something from Singapore. You see that in terms of overall use, a survey of 2,000 Singaporeans conducted by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, they found that 77% of the respondents use Facebook overall, 52% use it for news. We see 86% use WhatsApp, 42% use it for news. In another survey that I did in October 2017, I also asked them how often they use each different types of news source, you know, ranging from print newspapers to social media. So when I first moved to Singapore to start work, I did a similar survey that was in 2014, and back then, reading print was still the most frequently used news source. So for me, as a former print journalist, I was like, this is cool, you know, I'm joining I'll be in a country where, you know, print still reigns supreme. But when I did this survey 2 years later in 2016 and also in 2017, and I keep on seeing this trend now, reading news on Facebook is now the most common way of getting news. And for me, that's quite interesting. So why would people now shift to reading news on Facebook and abandon traditional platforms? And so in another thing, in the same survey, I also asked questions about, well, how credible do you find this information from these different sources are? And there's no surprise. Even in Singapore, people find information from traditional sources such as print and TV to be credible, at least the most credible in across different choices. And they find social media news and WhatsApp news as least credible. But then I also asked, well, how entertaining do you think these different types of news sources are? And they find social media news to be the most entertaining, which I think is quite interesting. So if we go back to the earlier slide, they get their news mostly from Facebook, which they consider as the least credible, right? Here they say print and TV are the most credible sources of news, but they don't get their news as often there as they get it from Facebook. So I think it tells us that credibility might no longer be the main driving force of news consumption, at least not as important as what we would like to think it is, right? Especially, you know, those who do journalism studies, right? If you look at experiments testing effects of different types of news characteristics, the dependent variable is always credibility, right? That we want to find out what makes people perceive a news story to be credible. Assuming that credibility then leads to news consumption and news processing and making decisions based on news. But it looks like credibility is no longer an important driving force of news consumption. What drives news consumption now? I don't have a ready answer. I think it's an open question that is quite important for us to continue investigating. So this leads me to our studies of news content. What it is about fake news that makes it look like news, right? So a lot of studies on fake news focus on the fakeness of fake news, which we've established by now that all the reason we call them fake news is because they're fake. But we've taken for granted how news-like they are, right? If they derive part of their power from being able to look like real news, we thought it's important to ascertain how much mimicry is involved there and how successful they are in mimicking. So when we talked about real news, those who do research on news content, there are several markers of traditional news. One would be news values, right? We know when we teach journalism students, well, news should be timely, right? It should be geographically proximate, or at least psychologically proximate. Usually news tends to be negative and whatnot. We also talk about news topics, right? When we talk about traditional news, it's all about politics or crime. This is what interests people. Then we can also talk about the format, right? We've come to associate the inverted pyramid format as the quintessential default format for telling news stories, that you start with the most important and then you go into decreasing importance, right? And finally, we always talked about objectivity in the news, right? That journalists shouldn't include themselves in the story, that they shouldn't be including their personal opinions in the story and also in their data collection methods. And so we can also consider objectivity, even if it's a problematic concept in journalism, to be a marker of traditional news. So what we did was we had a content analysis of articles that we got from fake news sites, so sites that have been declared as fake news sites, and about 800 of them, and we did a human content analysis to look at these specific markers. So I've done a similar project before, focusing on BuzzFeed, you know, trying to see whether BuzzFeed, do any of you follow BuzzFeed, right? It's wonderful, with all the cat videos and the lists that you can find there. So in an earlier project, I tried to measure whether BuzzFeed behaves like a real news provider, you know, comparing it with New York Times or not, and I used the same marker. So the results I'm sharing here are not from the same timeline. The BuzzFeed, New York Times are within the same timeline, but the fake news articles are sourced from a different timeline. So the comparison isn't 100% valid, but I think it gives us a good sense just to be able to compare. So when it comes to news values, we see that, you know, all timeliness, negativity, and prominence, a lot of these are news values that we tend to associate with traditional news. They're all there, especially negativity. So we see that at least the corpus of data we had for the content analyses, most of them are about something negative, but the impact is quite low. I think this is probably due to a lot of the very trivial stories that we see, right? Your fake sushi, which won't really affect a lot of people. I think one of the most viral stories in 2016 wasn't an election-related issue, but it was about like someone winning the lottery and doing nasty stuff on her boss's desk, so that even, you know, outperformed real news from the elections. So those are low impact stories. But when we talk about timeliness, negativity, and prominence, we see that fake news looks even more like real news than real news. I mean, containing the news values that we've associated with real news. In terms of news topics, we see that half of the corpus of data that we had are about government and politics. So this is one example of the trivial news, you know. Quite fun to read, though. There's also focus on crime and terrorism, and there's also focus on science, health, and technology. I think these are all the herbal medicines or the cat dog meat that you see, that you read on fake news stories. But again, quite typical of real news stories to focus on these topics. And then when it comes to news format, this was also surprising to us. Almost all of them use the inverted pyramid format, which is, again, you know, a very basic news writing format. And again, even more frequently than either New York Times or BuzzFeed. We were thinking they would be less sophisticated in writing style, maybe just writing it in a chronological way, or a narrative format, but there is some level of sophistication there, of knowing, I guess, internal rules of journalism. And this might not be surprising, considering some studies that have been done focusing on producers of fake news. So I have colleagues who focus on fake news network in the Philippines, and they found that some people who are involved in the fake news ecosystem during the 2016 elections were actually public relations practitioners or former journalists. And so they know the rules quite well, right? And maybe that's somehow part of the problem. But finally, for me, this is, I guess, not very surprising, but for me, one of the interesting findings we had is in terms of objectivity. So in this study, we coded for objectivity in terms of the presence of opinion of the author. So if there's an opinion, a subjective judgment, a form of evaluation in a text that's not associated with any news source, then we considered it as not objective, right? So if there are opinions in there, but they're always quoted or attributed to someone else, even if it's a fake person, a fake expert, but at least it's not implied that it's the opinion of the author, then we quoted it as objective. So what we see here is, this is a point of departure. Unlike New York Times or BuzzFeed, when we did this study, most of the articles were objective. In the corpus of data we had for fake news stories, most of them were subjective. And this, again, I have no evidence for this, but it could be, this could be part of the reason why fake news has been quite potent, right? Is that they feed into people's personal biases, right? And we already know that, but I think this finding makes it even more obvious that they're very subjective, and that's why they thrive. And it's no surprise. We have news organizations who are known for their political biases, and they don't hide their political biases, and they still do very well. They're still the most watched news network, at least in their home country. So I think that's quite interesting and something that we might need to look further into. And the next project that I will share would be, again, a preliminary. We've had more examples of messages at this point. But what we've been doing is I'm working with a group of students, and they're asking their friends or family members or parents to forward to them things that they've forwarded to others or have been forwarded in their group chats. So I don't know if you're part of any group chats, but in my part of the world, even with my family, I have group chats with my family. So your parents are there, and sometimes, you know, they forward you articles. A lot of them are not real. So we're trying to look into what gets forwarded. So this is not just fake news, but anything that gets forwarded in a group setting, right? So WhatsApp allows you, I think, up to 200 plus members in a group. And then you can just share, you can share anything there. It's like messaging the whole group, and they get access to the message. So we're looking at examples, and the first pattern that we saw across these different forwarded messages is that they are always, most of them are about personal or actionable issues. So it could be something that occurred, there's a checkpoint at this area, or there's an accident in this area, or someone's car got broken into in this particular spot. So these are things that you can act on, that you can protect yourself against, or that you can prepare for. We didn't see a lot of more macro social level issues, but more micro issues that could affect people's daily lives. The second pattern that we saw is they're very conversational. So if you look at this example, I hope you can see it. It's like a message that you get from a friend, right? The way the text is written, there's a greeting, Happy New Year. There's a use of exclamation points, use of ellipses. If you see from here, this is even told into a very personal way, almost a narrative, right? Starts with, you know, my sister bought this and whatnot. So again, this is what we're seeing when we looked into WhatsApp, which is, again, a close messaging app, which is quite different from what we saw when we look at fake news from fake news websites. And the thing here is, WhatsApp is more difficult to track because it's encrypted. And second is, you have to gain access to that group to see what people are exchanging, unlike studying a fake news site where everything is there, or studying maybe looking at people's fake news timelines or walls where everything is there. On WhatsApp, you have to be part of the group to see what messages are getting exchanged. So one way of going around that is I'm asking my friends to just forward to us what their parents forward them. So that's the second thing that we saw, is the format, the writing style, quite conversational. Then the third one is there are some reference to experts. If you see here, so this one came from Dad. You see that there is a reference to a police chief, right? And in this instance, I tried to screenshot the brother, one of the sons, actually posted a link to a correction. You can also see here, again, there's a combination of being personal and referring to an expert. So the one who created this message says, "My younger brother, Dr. Justice Arthur." Even the first name is quite an expert, Justice, right? So again, there's appeal to experts. I think that, again, that's quite interesting. And finally, another pattern that we saw is a call to action, that usually they always start or end with "please forward," saying that it's urgent. And then you see here, "send it to someone you care about as soon as you get it." So this is quite common in a lot of the forwarded messages that we saw. And you think by now people will be sophisticated, that if they see something that you should forward, then the more you should not forward it, right? But again, we still see this from a lot of the group chats that we looked at. But some people still follow the call to action. So again, in summary, these are the things that we saw. One thing that is also emerging that I'm interested to look into once we have the complete data set is to focus on the omission of details. The time element is rarely there. And I think this is what helps fake news and other types of disinformation to resurface. And it has happened with every time there's a strong typhoon coming to the Philippines, I would always see even my aunt. She would always... we had a strong typhoon approach to the Philippines a few months ago, and she forwarded to the group family chat a screenshot of CNN saying the strongest typhoon ever recorded on Earth is coming to the Philippines. But this one was a screenshot of a CNN broadcast in 2013, I think, when we had Typhoon Haiyan, which then was the strongest ever recorded typhoon to hit on Earth. So again, that was true, but it was being repurposed. I don't know for what reason. And for me, what's interesting with WhatsApp is the people who produce fake news and other types of disinformation on WhatsApp, they don't really... I'm not sure if they earn money from it, because it's a closed app. There's no advertising mechanism, but you know, they still put together some effort in doing this and sharing this. They really can't monitor how viral their post gets, but I don't know why they do it. So I think it might be interesting to really get into their psyche and understand the motivations. I mean, for Facebook or for having fake websites, it's pretty straightforward. You're getting all of the Google AdSense, the clicks that you can convert into advertising revenues. But for WhatsApp, and it's a very vibrant disinformation ecosystem on WhatsApp and other, I would assume, other closed messaging apps. I've read an article that in France, even Snapchat was being used to spread disinformation. And again, for me, that's interesting, because the Snapchat, I don't use Snapchat, but those of you who use, I mean, the messages disappear after a few seconds, right? So there's even no record for it, which makes it even more dangerous, because you get exposed, so you don't have the evidence or you don't have the exact message with you to double check after. But I don't know what's the incentive there. What if fake news is motivated by either financial or ideological motivation? I don't know how it pans out in... maybe it's more ideological, but if you see like the poison durians, you know, being spread around, I don't know what's the ideological motivation for that. It could be, I've read work on misinformation warfare, that some actors consider information warfare as a more effective and less costly way of attacking other actors. So one way is to just bring down consumer confidence and let the economy, you know, suffer. So that's a more cost-effective way of doing it. Maybe that's part of it. But again, I think it'll be interesting to see what, especially for closed messaging apps, what motivates fake news producers and providers. Another thing that I'd like to share about is what we've been calling as a form of informational apathy. So this is now after the initial exposure. So Facebook and I would guess other platforms have ways of allow people to respond to the different types of information, problematic information that they see. So, like Facebook allows users to flag a piece of a post that they see, and one of the options to flag it is whether it's false news. So you can actually do that. And I've done that to my math teacher, my high school math teacher. So there was one time he was sharing a lot of stuff. I decided to do something when he posted a link to an article that said, breaking news, Pope Francis is actually the devil. There's a nice picture, it's a news article, and so I reported the post. It took about 4 days before Facebook notified me that they've accepted my flag and that they're reviewing it. At some point I found out it was taken down. Facebook, if you do a reporting, it also, automatically lets you send an automated message to the one who posted it via Messenger. I decided to tweak that to be more respectful and say, you know, we have, you know, there's a lot of us who look up to you, and some people might misunderstand this as you endorsing this story. So I hope you can take it down. And then he told me that, well, I'm not sure if it's true. That's why I posted it. He's waiting for someone to correct it. So I sent him... You don't really need someone to correct you to know that, you know. But anyway, that's beside the point. But after that, he actually stopped sharing, posting fake news stories on his newsfeed. I would monitor. I would always look into his timeline. And he stopped sharing that. But what he did next was he started sending me links to stories and forwarded messages on Messenger. And if he does that to me, he's probably doing it to his other friends. And again, that's more difficult to track. So once in a while, I would respond and send him a link to Snopes.com or say that, you know, this is wrong. One time he responded to me in all caps. He's saying, we were just discussing this in our faculty meeting, and even, you know, our acting principal said that we should be careful. It's about the equinox. You know, I think there's a time of the year when it's the longest daytime. I guess you experience this here all the time. But from where I'm from in the equator, they said there's a particular time when it's the longest daytime. And somehow when the planets and the sun align in a particular way, it can be harmful to your health. So you need to drink water and be careful and don't go out. So I told him that there's a specific range of time for equinox to happen. It actually happens every year, but it's already June. It's the rainy season in the Philippines. But then that's when he responded to me in all caps. He said, let's just be careful and wait and see. For me, that personal experience made me look into why others don't correct others when they see this information. And this is what we saw in the survey. So in the same survey that we did with Rich, we asked people how often they do any of these things when they see, when they are successful in detecting fake news online, on social media. And what was surprising was when we did this the first time in 2016, 77% said they would just do nothing. They would ignore the post. It's a three-wave survey, so we asked the same set of people over the years. It shows a decreasing trend, you know, the how often you ignore this information. I think part of that is the media discourse that has been generated by this issue. So in Singapore, because of the government's proactive stance, it's always in the headlines. I think people are becoming more aware, but still, in 2018, that's still 63%, it's still a majority of the respondents saying they will just ignore a post. So a subsequent project that we did was we tried to interview people, we asked people, what would make you correct this information that you see? And they mentioned three things. First is when the issue is relevant to them. And I think that makes sense, right? If you really feel passionate about an issue, then that's when you correct. But it still allows this information to thrive. If you see radioactive sushi being sold in this restaurant and you're not a sushi person, right, then you don't do anything, right? But for others who love sushi, they might still shy away from that restaurant. Again, there's some economic effects on that. Another thing that they mentioned is the type of interpersonal relationships. So many of the people we interviewed said that if they don't have strong connections with this person, then they would not do anything because they don't want to be involved in unnecessary arguments, you know, with people they don't really care about. So they want to avoid arguments. We have two people though, like one interviewee said that even if her mom shares a lot of fake stories, she couldn't get herself to explicitly correct her mom. So she would try to send links to particular sites, but she also didn't want to hurt, I guess, a loved one by explicitly saying that this time you're wrong. In focus groups that we've run for a project, some people said that actually being corrected is effective in making them more careful, especially when we did a focus group on older the older generation. They said that they minimize the frequency of them sharing to a group chat after a younger relative corrected them. But there's also a boomerang effect. So one interviewee said that we asked this person how did they behave? How did they react when someone corrected them? And then this person said, well, I kept on posting more stuff just, you know, to drive the attention away from the initial error. But again, it might also lead to posting more disinformation. And then the third factor that we found in the interviews is personal efficacy. Some people just believe that even if I correct someone, it won't do anything. This person already posted this, meaning they believe in this, and no correction from me will change that person's mind. So I think there's the low personal efficacy. I have a group of students from a class that I taught who also did a similar thing, and they found something interesting as well. They found a bystander effect. Some of their interviewees said that they'll just wait for someone else to correct this person so it wouldn't be them. So I think all in all, what we're seeing is not only a devaluing of information, we're valuing information no longer for its credibility, but maybe for its entertaining value or maybe for its social value. If I share this, I'll get more likes, or if I share this to my friends, it'll be outrageous, they'll find it funny. If I share this fake sushi to my friend, then maybe that my friend would think I'm being considerate, or this friend is concerned about my health. And I think we're also seeing a ecosystem of low value for information, and therefore people don't correct anymore. So I'd like to end with the overall context. Something that we've been thinking about, but we've not done any studies. If you've done anything, maybe you can share. I'll be happy to hear about what you've been finding. This is my most favorite fake news story ever. I have a couple of friends on Facebook, smart, very nice people who actually like this story, that our president, President Duterte, was declared as the best president in the solar system. So, Philippine pride. So I think that the two main contexts we wanted to see is, you know, fake news thrives in an age of information overload. Maybe the devaluing of information comes from just having so much information around us, right? And I think some psychology studies have done this. When people are made to choose out of 20 plus options versus when they're made to choose from only 6, they value their choice from the smaller option than from the wider option. So maybe we're seeing something similar. I'm not sure, but it's an interesting thing to find out. Another thing is fake news thrives in periods of instability. And I think if you bring this together, when there's a period of instability and there's lack of information, people tend to believe in the first few flows of information that they get because they're craving for information. But maybe when it isn't a period of instability, but there's just too much information, and so there's really low motivation to process and be critical, maybe that's also a time that people get vulnerable to fake news. So bringing all these together, we might be looking at a perfect storm, given all these different factors or different tools that, you know, facilitate the spread of disinformation. Again, there's still a lot of things to do, and I'd be happy to discuss and talk about this and hear about your ideas and your studies today and tomorrow. So, thank you.
When is 5 minutes?
secret. And as you can see here, the reason why Tina knows so much about what I'm doing is because we work together on the project on alternative media. Thank you for this great conference. And I really enjoyed the presentations today. I was thinking with the previous presentations, this idea of what counts as disinformation. And it's already been problematized. And I think this presentation is going to further problematize it. Because these kind of far-right news alternative media actors would definitely say that their intention is to enlighten, not to disinform. That they are telling the truth, and that everyone else is telling, you know, what is false. So the idea of intention needs to be also problematized, because do we ask them what their intention is, or do we ask other people from the outside to define what their intention is? So in this project, I'm also concerned with, you know, one aspect is what kind of content do they produce, and can we call it disinformation, like Eva was talking about, and that we heard earlier in the presentations, also on false news. But also who they try to criticize or characterize as misleading. So we have been interested in this role that alternative far-right news have as persistent and vocal media critics. So as you can hear, that we are positioning ourselves in the kind of literature on boundary work in journalism, about the journalistic authority, about the emerging peripheral actors, the emotional turn in journalism, populist political communication, and disinformation. You know, who is kind of telling the truth, and this battle that goes on. And while press criticism is largely understood as a necessary dimension of democratic dialogue, it can also take on less constructive forms like skepticism, cynicism, hostility, or mistrust. And that's also why we're so concerned with this. We're afraid of these things, and we're afraid of polarization and what will happen when people tend to use this or that media. So basically, this is going to be a case study where we can see how these boundaries are negotiated and how the journalistic community responds or try to counter these kind of initiatives. So in 2018, two of the most outspoken far-right critics of Norwegian mainstream media applied for membership in the National Editors Association, which can kind of be said to be the very stronghold of the media establishment. The editors represented two far-right outlets. They mirror these kind of far-right outlets that we can see in many countries. Here you can see Document, which is got quite a long history. It was launched as a political blog in 2003, but have moved more into kind of producing news, analysis, etc. And the other one is a more recent phenomenon. It was called Reset. And it was launched in as a reaction to the migration crisis in 2015, and also as a response to the U.S. election, because these kind of topics also kind of come together, we can see in many of these sites. So the presentation today is part of an ongoing project on far-right media and politics online, and we interview editorial leaders in alternative news sites, as well as their counterparts, the kind of main press and their organizations, in Scandinavia. And we have, in addition, done document analysis and analysis of the public debate regarding these kind of memberships. So this is a case study of the Norwegian sites. So we aim to answer three questions. Why did this hardcore critics apply for membership? And how did the professional community, professional association, deal with these kind of applications? And what can this tell us about this ongoing boundary work on the media system level, institutional level, which I think is a little bit under research. A lot has been going on about practices and processes and content. And in one of the interviews that we're doing, you know, these have been called kind of immigration critical alternative media, all these kind of things. But as we can see in this quote, they really focus on this idea of media criticism. Undoubtedly, our most successful stories concerns media criticism. It is not stories about immigration or Islam. It is about media criticism. It is a market here. People want to read about it. They want stories where we go after famous media profiles and critically examine what they say. We do so because no one else will, and it's fundamental for our business. So basically, they can see, you know, journalists, they do not criticize each other. This is a lack, you know, and people are critical towards the mainstream media. Let's go for it. So we have conducted a study before on media criticism, and we have tried to analyze different, you know, how should we understand media criticism? And one dimension is criticizing journalism or journalism practices or individual journalists versus kind of an anti-system critique. Do you believe in the system? Do you believe in journalism as an institution or not? And we have also identified different kind of positions of authority that these media critics talk from, you know, because the anti-elitist media criticism is quite well known, coming from the populist line of research. But we also find other different kind of positions that they're talking from, an expert position, meaning that they're experts, for instance, on Islam or something else, and that they know a lot about it, you know, reports and everything. From a victim position, that they have had bad experiences with the journalists and mistreated by mainstream media, for instance, being rejected or ridiculed. Also, insider position, that many of these people working here, not all, but some of them, have insider knowledge about what it means to be a journalist, have background from journalism, but have then decided to go to the alternative side. And also this kind of activist position, where you do a lot of stunts, it's more for the extreme sides, for instance, like this Nazi sides that do a lot of media staging. So the case that I'm going to talk about, so I made this because it's a little bit, a lot of organizations in Norway, and the media system in the Nordic countries, as you probably all know, by if you read your Halina Mancini, is that we belong to the what is called the democratic corporatist model. And this is characterized by an active state intervention in the media market through very generous press support systems. However, also institutionalized editorial freedom and strong journalistic autonomy. So one way this kind of strong journalistic autonomy is secured is through a high degree of independence from the state and strong consensus about common ethics and values. And a cornerstone in this system is the role of the Norwegian Press Association, which is an umbrella organization for all editorial-driven media in Norway, including the Editors Association, Journalistic Association, and the Media Industry Association, or unions, you can call them. Very important in this project is that the Norwegian Press Association administrates the Press Complaint Commission that deals with all complaints against editorial-driven media in Norway. And they follow the code of ethics for Norwegian journalists that all Norwegian journalists from editorial-driven media adhere to. So we will have one code of ethics. And this story starts as the Press Complaint Commission, which used to also open up for complaints made by the public against publishers that were not part of these member organizations, changed their status. And this was because, as you can see here, this is the status, and this line here that I've underlined was the sentence that was taken away, which in essence meant that only organizations that are part of these member organizations could be made a complaint against. And this was due to an increase of complaints against alternative news sites. And as the General Secretary of the Norwegian Press Association suggested, this is a strain on the system, and they are not paying for it. So basically they're using the system to get some kind of legitimacy, but they are not supporting it. So it was a lot of discussions about this, and in the end it was decided that it would be taken away, which means that all actors that wanted to be included in this system had to become part of one of the organizations. And as the General Secretary again said, she said, this will entail that some of our member organizations will receive some applications that will be very difficult to handle. And this is exactly what happened. So these two editors then applied for membership in the Association for Editors. So why did they do that? Why did they want to be included in the system? And how did the journalistic community react? So our analysis showed that there was a strong motivation to seek recognition from other editors within the system. And this can be seen in this kind of quote from Document. We are not activists, we are journalists. Document is a serious online publication. We produce serious journalism, and that can argue systematically and consistent for the choices that we do. So basically they define themselves as an alternative, but also as journalists. And as you can see, also the kind of need to be recognized by the journalistic community. But it's also an element here of trying to have impact, as you can see from this quote. We want good, critical, and diverse press. It's only natural that we try to influence the Association of Editors and their members in the right direction. This is best done by becoming a member. It will also be interesting for us to hear more about how editors think about themselves and about their assets. But basically, it's kind of, you can see this, you're moving towards the mainstream, but still you want to be on the outside. So the reactions when these applications came from the journalistic community and others was, in one way, maybe it's good that they are on the inside. Maybe it will be a disciplining element that they will actually produce better journalists and they will be held account. But others were very afraid that this also would mean that it would mean a kind of a legitimizing of their ideological position. And also some were afraid that they would challenge the system from within. And as you can say here, this is a quote from one of the editors from the mainstream press, it's an online newspaper. They cannot operate it within the boundaries of ethical rules. When they apply for membership, it's trolling, which is a win-win situation for them. If they are denied membership, they become martyrs. And if they're accepted, they can be part of the self-regulatory system. And they can be found guilty of breaching the ethical codes, which again make them martyrs for their kind of audiences. So basically the outcome was that Document was accepted, the editor of Document was accepted, and the editor of Reset was declined. And these are the reasons were given by the Editors Association. First of all, that they had tried to pay a source, a young man, $45,000 to come forward in a story concerning a sex encounter with a female politician. And this was seen as a serious breach of the ethical codes. Secondly, that their comment sections that were pre-moderated was horrific. And it consisted of racism and hate speech. And thirdly, that they had a call for boycott of mainstream media. You know, it's kind of, they encourage people to take a break from the mainstream media and from the NRK, the public service broadcaster, and that would be healthy for us. And that was seen as a very disloyal thing to do when I interviewed the Editors Association. You could not boycott other media. And the reactions from this organization, Document, they said, I think we were accepted because we produce professional journalism. But, however, the board is also aware of the strong political right-wing movement in Europe, and they think these people need to have a platform. Document is their platform. Maybe it's right that they're given a chance to be heard. So in one way, legitimizing their position, at least that was how it was understood. And the Reset, he was rejected. Well, I don't mind staying on the outside. Media criticism is easier for those who are not part of the group that is being criticized. But in the interview, I must say, he seemed very disappointed. So, what can this tell us? First of all, it informs the discussion of boundary negotiations at the institutional level, the media system level. And, you know, for future research, we need to also address, you know, so what are the position of code of ethics? Is that something shared amongst many journalists or all journalists? Or is it divided? What can it tell us about the media system? Because if we want to put, you know, these actors on the continuum, we also need to address what kind of criteria we need. And the role of institutions, do they have strong support or are they quite weak? Also, it says something about this kind of blurring boundaries and professionalization processes that occur. So whether or not, you know, it can be very alternative or very mainstream, that can also change. It's not static. And it also informs us about this kind of legitimate or illegitimate, I hate that word, media criticism. Here, you know, the boundaries of what, you know, journalists are encouraged to do media criticism, but to boycott other media, that is seen as a no-no. Thank you.
Great, thanks. Okay, nothing is happening. That's bad news. Okay, thanks. My name is Birgitte Honshus. I'm a research fellow at the Norwegian Center for Holocaust and Minority Studies and also a PhD candidate in media studies at the University of Oslo. I'm going to present this case study of anti-Semitic propaganda in extreme right alternative media, which I'm conducting together with Carolina. And I'm going to try to keep it short so we can have some interesting questions and discussions afterwards. So the background for this study is, well, it's a part of my PhD project on anti-Semitism in contemporary Norway. Hostility and prejudice towards Jews are on the rise in Western societies. Recent reports from EU and several NGOs have emphasized how online media appears to play an important role in this development. But so far, the topic has been given limited scholarly attention. So, in this study, we explore how the anti-Semitic propaganda is constructed on the website frihetskamp.net. The website is owned by the Norwegian division of a neo-Nazi organization, the Nordic Resistance Movement, which is the biggest neo-Nazi organization in the Nordic countries. It's the main organization is based in Sweden, but we also have, a Norwegian division with a few members, and they make a lot of noise. And as you can see from this, our point of departure is that the website can be characterized as extreme right, anti-democratic, activist media, and they regularly publish news. As you can see, the website to a large degree mimics the layout, visual layout of a regular online newspaper. They publish news daily and are very much inspired by what's going on out there in the mainstream media coverage. So the website functions as an information hub for the members of the organization, but also potentially for a wider audience. Previous research has underlined how marginal and extreme actors on the one side promote anti-system, anti-elite, and anti-democratic attitudes. On the other hand, they often refer or link to mainstream news sources, even if they are highly critical of them, as we have also previously heard. when it can be used to support their exclusionary, hostile worldview. Little is known, however, about how news stories from other sources, such as mainstream media, are manipulated to suit the overall purpose of such actors. So in this study, we aim to meet this research gap by conducting a case study of how anti-Semitic propaganda is constructed and disguised as news on Frihetskamp.net. So the first question we ask in our study is what kind of media sources are used as background for the news published on this site? More specifically, we identify all media sources and categorize them as either mainstream, alternative, or social media. Then we focus on the mainstream news, how the mainstream news become neo-Nazi news, and ask how are mainstream media sources used and manipulated to create news with an anti-Semitic message? And finally, what kind of anti-Semitic sentiments dominates the news coverage? Today, I will present to you a few preliminary findings, but focus in particular on research question two. And I'm going to very, very quickly say something about data and methods. So we've collected all articles published on the website containing the search word Jew in the headline from 2011 to 2018. 2011 was when the website was established. It's 128 articles. In addition, we've also collected all the media sources that are linked to. Still counting and double-checking this number, but somewhere in between 90 and 100 mainstream media sources are linked to. So we're also looking at those. So we use quantitative content analysis to identify these media sources. And in the next step, we analyze more qualitatively how these news are manipulated into anti-Semitic news. So we compare the neo-Nazi news to the mainstream source and identify the use of coded language and angles of framing used in the article. So very preliminary, but here are some of the mainstream media news sources that are used and often referred to. We have Aftenposten, one of the biggest daily newspapers in Norway. Also Dagbladet. We have The Guardian. And interestingly, also quite frequently they refer to what I would call maybe mainstream, like niche media, like the Jerusalem Post, Times of Israel, that are news outlets that are about Israel, the Middle East conflict, Jewish interests in Israel and the U.S. So the neo-Nazis refer and use these Jewish outlets as a source for their propaganda. They also refer to, but less than the mainstream media, they refer to sources like Breitbart, we all know that. Fria Tider is a Swedish alternative media site. The Daily Stormer is a neo-Nazi site. And quite often they also refer to different YouTube videos or quotes on Twitter. But I'm not going to focus so much on that. As I said, it seems like the mainstream sources are more commonly used than the alternative and the social media sources. So the news often simulates sort of neutral reporting. However, in some, they constitute a hyper-partisan worldview, which is very much anti-Semitic. So here we have the first example. How does mainstream news become anti-Semitic propaganda? I'm going to show you a couple examples. So we see the headline here is Heavy Criticism of Trump on the Red Carpet. And it's about how, this is from Dagbladet, one of the biggest daily newspapers in Norway. And Dagbladet's article is about how the Hollywood actors attending an award show used the opportunity to protest against President Trump's strict immigration policies. And then the neo-Nazis on Frihetskamp were inspired by this, made a similar news story, where the headline is Jewish Hollywood actors protests against Trump. So this neo-Nazi article here clearly emphasized the Jewish identity of the Hollywood actors. These two, Simon Helberg and Jocelyn Towne. The article also mentions Meryl Streep, but calls her Jewish Meryl Streep. It's very important to emphasize that. In addition, and not visible here, is the use of keyword tags, very like subtle at the end of the article, to sort of target what's this really about. The tags they use are the Jewish question, cultural Marxism, and mass immigration. Especially the tag, the Jewish question, is sort of pointing back to the old conspiratorial trope of how the Jews were considered a big problem in Europe. At the end of the 19th and beginning of 20th century. So very much using that sort of old anti-Semitism, but with more of code words than saying it out loud. So the overall message of this news article is more complex than it first seems. You could say that it's about how Jews are disloyal towards the society they live in. In this case, they oppose the president. Secondly, Hollywood are full of Jews. Other similar news articles from the same site also emphasize how Hollywood are controlled by Jews, and that this have an effect on us as an audience or watching TV shows and stuff like that. Also that Jews are communists and socialists, and completely the opposite of what these guys stand for. It also says something about how they believe that Jews in general are pro-mass immigration and thus responsible for the destruction of the American and or the Western society and white people, basically. And have another example, an opinion piece from Bloomberg. The focus of the Bloomberg columnist is about, it's about Friedrich Merz, at this time a possible successor of Angela Merkel as the leader of the Christian Democratic Union. The presentation in Bloomberg is more or less neutral. As you can see, the headline is Merkel's would-be successor is a real conservative. Focuses on his political and professional background. And when this news story sort of hits the Frihetskamp site, the headline is different. The leader of a Jewish finance corporation wants to take over for Merkel. They emphasize, again, the Jewish identity of this corporation, where this guy serves as a chairman. The article frames Jews as frauds and as powerful in European and American politics. It is claimed that this Jewish corporation actively worked for the destruction of white people by promoting and supporting multiculturalism and the LGBTQ movement. In addition, not visible here, again, use of keyword tags such as the Jewish question, Jewish power. So the overall message is very conspiratorial. Jews have too much power. They are notorious criminals, responsible for the destruction of the white population. So example two is more explicit than example number one. Both examples illustrate typical anti-Semitic sentiments, which can be found on this site. Yeah. to conclude very, very briefly, so the anti-Semitic propaganda on this site are often disguised as news, inspired by events from mainstream media coverage. Based on the organization's ideology, we expected that these ideas would be very explicitly communicated, but this is not always the case. They often use codes, hints, humor to express their anti-Semitic views. So the message becomes less obviously hostile and thus potentially could reach a wider audience, people that are unfamiliar with this kind of ideas. And, well, people that may be more responsive to believe in these kinds of news stories. I'm going to stop there and ready for questions. Thank you.
We still have something like 10 minutes for a question. It would be great if the speakers could just all come down here. And I know Tina has to leave soon, so if there are questions for Tina, it would be great if you could ask them.
And then my the big mic.
Okay, I first.
Can we give them the mic?
No, I did.
It's like a proper talk show.
Is this working? Okay. I really enjoyed all four of these papers, and I think one of the upsides to what you've all sort of gone about in different angles is starting to tackle the nuances that are really present in a lot of these discussions. For instance, Ava, I liked that picture you had sort of captured something that I've been wrestling with. How do you disaggregate or how do you aggregate a site that sometimes gets it newsy and sometimes gets it very far off the mark? And you can see this also in the typology that you're starting to work on, Tina and Carolina, and you're seeing all of these nuances come out, which are really welcome and make me wish I had written stuff on this now when I could benefit from all of that. But there's sort of an underlying question that I keep coming back to, which is like the for whom question, right? When we look at these problematic sites, for whom is it problematic? For whom do they speak for, and who are they speaking to? And maybe it's a sort of question we can't, it's probably a question we can't resolve here. But something to bear in mind is that I'll put it myself, when I as a researcher look at these sorts of sites that I find problematic, and I try to step back and say, well, for their audiences, are they actually quite informative or speak to them in community building, sociality, you know, all of those other things that journalism does? Am I imposing a paternalistic gloss over this all? Am I prescribing a normative view of it, which I like seeing? You know, let's get a non-normative conceptualization around this, but I still think that's a thread that's going to go through. Maybe sometimes it's easier, we can say, well, hate is hate, and therefore, you know, the last paper, those are all examples that we may more easily decide should be problematized, but I still think that's a complexity that we may still want to wrestle with, and I'm curious if that's something you're also going about. So thank you.
Can I can use this?
I guess so.
Is it done? Yeah. It's at least very problematic for the media, the mainstream established media, because they haven't really found a good way to address this. And it's also problematic for politicians, because it's a lose-lose situation. Because the more you criticize, the more of a martyr the alternative actors can present themselves as. I think it's important for us to study because, as with all, we need to try to understand and unpack what is going on, because we know that these media are bending the boundaries And also I believe that the mix of proper journalism, of legitimate media criticism, with what we could characterize as non-legitimate or more cynicism or hostility, I believe it's the mix that is very appealing, that is broadly appealing, and that we need to try to study this properly.
Yeah, if I can just add to that, who's it a problem for, right? I mean, I think if you go out and ask people, what do you know about fake news? I mean, a lot of people actually name these sites, you know, because as I said, they are the easy target and they're so visible. And that's so, and then maybe it also sort of covers the real problem. And then we think, okay, now we just focus on them. And then we'll do something. And then as you say, you know, like actually, I mean, maybe prevent legitimate partisan opinion formation in a community. But that being said, what we do see is, given that they use Facebook so much, I think it is a problem in that sense that they often will be forwarded and shared in a context where you don't see anymore that you're part of a partisan community trying to form an opinion to go out into the mainstream public sphere, you know? So, and if that happens, and if they look newsy, that's again where we do get the problem. So it's not so much if you're dedicated enough and actually go to the website itself, but if it sort of becomes a blur, like on social media, and especially now if you see Fear to Unit, which has been banned on Facebook, you know, now they go on shadowy sites, now they tell their dedicated users, please forward this individually because we're being banned, you know, and then it sort of becomes more and more diffuse, and maybe then also more prone to like people, like even more the media literacy to decode what this is actually about.
Yes, I have a question for Carolina. I was fascinated with the sort of the whole notion of the credentialing of organizations, and I'm sort of thinking sort of almost in a Eric Olin Wright in his discussion about how credentialing plays through in various types of power relationships. But I'm also fascinated that it's so, you know, we're in a really fluid situation. I don't know how old Web 2.0 is, maybe 10, 15 years, something like that. But in a sense, there's a delegitimizing of particular institutions that perhaps with time will be washed away or rebuilt in various forms. And I'm asking you, in 20 years' time, is the Norwegian,
organization?
Yeah. Is it going to be some sort of a weird shadow thing or what?
Well, because you can see here kind of two scenarios in a way. Because what you can see here is basically a tightening of the system, you know, where it becomes easier in one way to define who's inside and outside, you know, by taking it away. So in one way, it's kind of confirming this organization and who's legitimate or not.
We'll
can we just take that word out of the English dictionary, please? It's too difficult for Norwegian people. But on the other side, that I didn't mention in my presentation, is that when they took out this sentence and then tightening the boundaries, they were also very scared what would happen. Would there be need for another type of complaint system that could be dealt with from the state? So, you know, when people don't have a place to complain, it could be blogs, you know, it could be these alternative sites. Would there be, for instance, like a press ombudsman or something that would be dealt, so that we would have parallel systems? And they were scared about that. So, you know, that could also be an option. And would it kind of, what would happen then, you know, in terms of the autonomy? It's difficult to say. But it's definitely going to be a lot more kind of situations like this. And also all these kind of different organizations have to go through the statutes to think like, okay, who can be a member and who cannot be a member? And I think that was, you know, this kind of process that the Norwegian Editors Association did now by evaluating a place, that's not happened before, and then doing like a press statement from it. It's never happened before.
Thanks for well, and Tina, who's gone, lovely presentations, and I like the thread. Scott sort of already got what I was going to get at. I'm an audience researcher, so that's sort of why. But it strikes me, I'm curious about the term, it's even in the title here, of alternative news media, especially when I think of it that way, from an audience point of view, because I know we're having to label them something to try to understand them, and journal editors and people like that really want us to like be clear on our terms and what we're talking about and what we're not. But if we're actually trying to understand the phenomenon, right? And we're sort of, we're taking, it seems here, a very ethic or at least producer-centered view. There's the mainstream, they're old, their legacy, and all these other things are the alternative, which then leads one to question, I think Tina was trying to get at this, but she left, like, trying to specify what we mean by alternative. But I'm wondering if we look at it again from a more emic perspective, from the people, because when Ava was talking about, you know, misleading people, and then I think it was actually Carolina who said, well, they actually think they're leading people almost more, you know? Like, they don't think they're misleading people. And I was thinking about the last one with Brigida, like, this thing about, you know, Jewish actors. And I'm wondering if I was a Muslim and reading the mainstream and seeing, you know, a local Muslim community leader, I would probably be thinking, why do you have to say Muslim community leader? Why am I not just a community leader? So I guess basically what I'm trying to get at is, when you're studying these things and sticking with this sort of mainstream alternative, does it at some point cease to be a meaningless distinction from an emic perspective? I understand from an etic perspective, but I'm wondering if we just, from an etic perspective, it becomes boundary work. The mainstream, and they're trying to police against this alternatives. But from an emic perspective, I'm wondering how meaningful you still find this mainstream alternative as a conceptual category.
Yeah, I know. I mean, every time I use the kind of alternative term, you know, I find it so difficult. And I think also, you know, I mean, there's been done research. I know Jennifer Walsh, who's been doing a lot of audiences before, she's also writing something about audiences of kind of far-right media now. I mean, I suppose it is the problem of trying to define something that is different, or that is, and what should be the kind of center from it. So, you know, in one way, I think it is useful to not call everything journalism, because then that meanings, that also loses its meaning. So, you know, I think when we study this, it is necessary to go through all these kind of precautions, maybe not starting all articles with saying, like, it was a leftist, it was used in a leftist tradition before, but it's, you know, and I think that's why Tina and the, you know, this article is helpful, because you need to distinguish how we kind of move from one to the other. I mean, there's done lots of important work now on kind of the mainstream and peripheral actors, you know, and then it's kind of the mainstream and alternative actors. But I think we need to be careful in terms of what kind of level we see them as alternative. And, I mean, Holt has been pushing this kind of, you know, the self-defined term. But, you know, I think that can't be the only parameter, in a way. Because then all the definitions go back to the different kind of actors. You know, it might be, but it's helpful, but it's also problematic. So yeah, I'm just going to give the mic to someone else.
I have one example that just struck me from this work, when I try to identify and encode different sources as mainstream, all or alternative, or social, or somewhere in between. There are some outlets that like Russia Today, would be considered mainstream in Russia, but alternative elsewhere, which makes it difficult. But and well, yeah, we have to talk about that.
Well, just to I mean, you totally have a point, of course, because I mean, if you consider the emic perspective, I mean, in a digital news report, they have asked people about why they consume these hyper-partisan alternative news sites, and I guess there are some that say, I do this, I have my mainstream news consumption, and then I do this if I need to get the facts straight, or whether I need another perspective, that sort of bring the alternativeness in their consumption as well. But there's a lot of that don't, right? They just perceive that as news. So yeah, so in that sense, that it is, I think it's going to stay a producer term. It's, and then we have to be very explicit and clear about that.
I mean, I have been struggling with it myself and saying, okay, should I just call them hyperpartisan media and digital alternative, even though I think it's a valid point with the anti-mainstream impetus they have, right? But isn't Fox News a hyperpartisan news outlet? And so, in that sense, isn't it still an element of importance that they have that self-perceived alternativeness? And I would still stick to that, but it is tricky.
Okay, we are running out of time, but we have two more questions.
Okay. Fine, sorry guys, I really wanted to keep this going.
And the reason is we should have a quick break.
Sorry.
Okay, cool. I hope, I suppose that you cannot hear me.
Now she starts. Luca and Matteo.
Yeah. Okay. So I hope and suppose that all of you can hear me and be able to see my slides. Good afternoon. Thank you for this chance to connect remotely with all of you in this stimulating conference. I'm so sorry I don't have the to actually be there in person. Congratulations for the great initiative to actually employ online tools to bring academics from different time zones and part of the world together. So I know that this will be a one-way communication, and hopefully I'll be able to give you some of my preliminary work that I've been working so far. My name is Dimitra Dimitropoulou. I'm a research fellow at the Media Lab at MIT. My study... Okay. So my study is situated within the current debate around fake news, dominating the public sphere, and shifting our attention lately to the growing complexities the entire information ecosystem. So as we're witnessing as users and investigating as scholars, misinformation easily spreads across the media, especially in the fluid online environment that proves accommodation for respondents. My presentation today is part of a 3-year European-funded project that I'm just embarking on that addresses scientific information using as the example case the movement against childhood vaccination. Using large-scale social media data, news media, and behavioral data, the project studies how pseudoscientific news is diffused within social networks and how it affects human judgment and behavior, aiming to enhance the efficiency of science communication and empower public health policy. So within this broader framework, I would like to share with you part of my preliminary work in the development of a conceptual toolkit that can be deployed to study misinformation in this context. Pseudoscience, and specifically the anti-vaccination movement, demonstrates a unique case study that indicates the longevity of the fake news phenomenon. As anti-vaccine myths started spreading decades ago, still feed the movement's narrative. The popularity of vaccine hesitancy is growing in many countries around the world, in spite of the scientific data that systematically debunk its claims, resulting in the resurgence of vaccine-preventable diseases. So within the digital terrain, anti-vaccination groups have grown in visibility and volume, and research demonstrates that social media constitute popular platforms for anti-vaccination supporters. Also, recent policy changes introduced in many countries around the world to enforce mandatory vaccinations highlight the devastating consequences that opting out of vaccination has had for public health. All the more, in a year of increased pressure towards social media platforms to be held accountable for the content that is spread with its users, the case study appears more timely than ever. So in this highly transforming ecosystem, identifying and debunking fake news once it has been spread and established in people's consciousness can become an extremely challenging process. Fake news leverages on existing perceptions and builds upon anxieties and fears, formulating an alternative version of the ground truth. At the same time, global scale research validates that the online space is the most prominent source for information and news. Online health information seeking is also rapidly increasing and often leads to misleading information and inevitably misinformed health decisions. 6 out of 10 Europeans go online when looking for health information, while similar trends are prevalent in the US. And I'm sure that most of us have done that at least once. So within the context of my study and in an effort to contribute to the definitional quest of fake news, I would like to introduce the concept of misinformation. So the term was originally used by Langdon Binner to identify the almost religious conviction that the widespread adoption of computers and communication systems, along with broad access to electronic information, will automatically produce a better world for humanity. Reframing the concept within the context of myths, we can approach the study of the diffusion of fake news to try to understand the human fundamental urge to translate complicated phenomena through simplistic interpretations in response to the allure of unreasonable or humbug narratives. So just like all civilizations with poor understanding of physical phenomena created myths to explain nature, history, or rituals to cope with adversities and major life events, postmodern network societies, often overinformed and misinformed, may just as well call on their own postmodern mythologies so as to make sense of our hyperconnected world. So I suggest that the concept of misinformation can be added to the typology of mis- and disinformation and malinformation to address widely held but false beliefs or ideas and misrepresentation of the truth that are portrayed as accurate and validated information. So applying the notion of the myth as developed by Roland Barthes, myth information may address the way popular ideas get stripped of their meaning, removed from their proper context, and then repackaged as true information. So myths are not just a genre of stories, they're a way of saying something, presenting an ethos, an ideology, or a set of values, as if it were a national condition of the world. So myths depend on the context where they exist, and by changing the context, one can change the effects of the myth. Myth doesn't seek to show or to hide the truth. When creating an ideology, it seeks to deviate from the reality. Myth is not deep enough to fit these contradictions. It simplifies the world and thus makes an impressive appeal to people. So what do fake news and myths have in common? The power of both lies in their impressive character. They both seek to surprise the audience. This impression is way more powerful than any rational explanations which can disprove this pseudo fact. So myths and fake news work not because they hide their intentions, but because their intentions have been naturalized. What they also share is that they imply an ethos or an ideology as the focus of belief. In order to be effective, they must be believed by their audiences. Myths and fake news abolish the complexity of human acts. They eventually organize a world which is without contradictions because it is without depth. So for this presentation, I will focus on narrated myths that are employed and deployed in two popular anti-vaccination Facebook groups using narrative analysis. Comments at the top of 50 influential posts of this group are coded manually and analyzed qualitatively, resulting to a variety of narrative threads that engage the users in a social network group. So my aim is not just to apply a thematic analysis of the content, but deep dive into an exploration of the pseudoscientific myths that are narrated on vaccination. Is then to use this acquired knowledge to develop a purposeful dictionary of vaccine-related terms and scale it to analyze a larger data set of social media posts. Let's have a look into the most prevailing claims in our study data. First, we have the myth of safety and effectiveness. Safety themes are one of the most commonly claimed arguments against vaccination. The coded comments claimed vaccines are poisonous and cause idiopathic illnesses, stressing that vaccines contain substances poisonous to humans. Questioning whether vaccines actually confirmed immunity was also common. This included propositions that vaccination weakens the immune system or that immunity is ineffective because vaccinated individuals still contract diseases. We don't have the myth of alternative science. So the analysis found misinformation or fabrication of scientific results to be widespread. Vaccine studies were often misrepresented or alternative scientific results were shared as the only truth. This included drawing false conclusions from research, using sources untruthfully, and describing data very selectively. Misleading statements were made, such as smallpox is not contagious or autism is caused by MMR vaccines, one of the actually most popular misinformed arguments. We then have the myth of public wisdom. So many users use these groups to ask for advice from other members on side effects after vaccination, natural remedies resulting from public wisdom, or even look for empirical diagnosis sharing photos of their sick children. A frequent narrative that is evident is the myth of the anti-system. So this refers to the vaccination refusers as claiming to be against the system, the political system and the medical system. So many comments include the notion of the system, where concerned parents and vaccine objectors were portrayed as battling corrupted physicians, government, and corporations. The conspiracy theory narrative was also very much present. Most comments made accusations of a cover-up, where regulatory bodies are purposefully hiding information about vaccines from the public. Equally as common were suggestions that vaccination is motivated solely by a quest for profit. The last narrated myth that I have analyzed is the myth of moral superiority. So the narrative of being morally superior is the only one scaring the only truth was very evident in the studied content. Parents who opposed vaccination portrayed themselves as intending to open the eyes of other parents who are hiding behind lies and potentially harming their children. So the current research highlights a particular challenge for public health communication in our digital habitat. Given strategies commonly used by public health actors are not always effective and may produce backfire effects on vaccine intention, the influence of social media interactions with anti-vaccination messaging from lay publics that is sometimes unclear, hostile and inaccurate may be particularly problematic. Anti-vaccination comments revealed a narrative attempt to provide pseudoscientific explanations for an unscientifically backed perspective. Vaccine objectors reject the facts presented to persuade them towards vaccination. For the anti-vaccination movement, misinformation is simply their version of information, an alternative truth. Misinformation and pseudoscientific evidence need to be condoned, yet each side of the debate labeling the other as wrong is ineffectual. Combating vaccine misinformation with education or counteractive and regulatory policies may prove necessary, but it seems that it's not sufficient. So I believe that greater appreciation of the discourse underlying is needed in order to understand the ideologies that support such beliefs. And to this direction, my study aspires to be heading. So thank you, everyone. I hope that I'll be able to read some of your comments or questions on Twitter. feel free to contact me if any parts of this work seem interesting, relevant to what you are what you're working on. So I'll be watching the rest of the conference on YouTube, and I wish the best of luck to the rest of the participants. Thank you for having me with you today.
And then I will now quickly turn and call Maria Celeste Wagner, who's a PhD student at the University of Pennsylvania and is currently working together with Pablo Bukowski, who's a professor at Northwestern University. And they have a larger qualitative study in the workings on the reception of fake news, the interpretations and practices that shape the consumption of perceived misinformation. As they are ready, so we're going to try a three-part call here. Hope this works. Hello, hello. Good to see you, good to see you. We have the audience ready. I will disconnect my headset here, and then you will be able to speak to everyone, and you can show your slides as full screen. Okay? Okay. The floor is yours. Looking forward. Sounds good, Pablo. All right. Best of luck.
To see.
Are you having some difficulty there with making it full screen? We cannot see your slides, so no. Now they're coming, yes. All right. I'll unplug so you can talk, okay?
Thank you much, Professor Westland, for organizing this eco-friendly panel, and everyone for being here today. So my name is Solesto Wagner. I'm a third-year PhD student at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, and I'm going to present our work with Pablo, who is also here this fall. On how U.S. adults interpret and develop information practices around perceived misinformation. So this is a work in progress. We just submitted our manuscript for a second round of reviews. So any comments or feedback that you might have, we really appreciate. So to give you some context, when we started this study in 2017, we started doing interviews, and while we were doing the field work and during the first rounds analysis, even though our interviews were around how people consume news in general and entertainment and technological devices, we started to realize that interviews frequently refer to the existence of fake news, the distrust in the media, and how they had adjusted their news habits due to these perceptions. So we decided to go and explore the literature on news, which has been profuse in the past years, and has attempted to identify and measure the spread of positive effects of fake news in the U.S., but in many different countries. So we don't have a lot of time here to go over all the trends, reasons, but overall we found most of these studies have really expanded our understanding of contemporary information, but have mostly relied on quantitative and computational methods to identify fake news and spread of misinformation online, but there's been less of a focus on how individuals are making sense of this new landscape and developing practices. So in order to explore how individuals are developing, usually develop news practices and interpret these practices, we explore the literature on news reception, which has traditionally studied the role of news consumption in everyday routines and how it operated according to specific spatial and temporal dynamics of everyday life. More recent studies on reading news online have focused on issues such as media practices across platforms, the construction of media repertoires, and specific online behaviors like sharing or commenting, what leads people to do these behaviors, and also on incidental news consumption as a byproduct of spending time on social media for different reasons. Nevertheless, there haven't been many studies focusing on credibility issues or the reception of perceived misinformation from user perspective. So we decided to go back to the literature and ask how do people make sense of, deal with the changing media landscape that is perceived filled with misinformation and fake news. So we try to contribute to this scholarship of misinformation and news reception, and we build on these two strands of research. So we contribute to adding perception angle to the studies of news and a fake news focus on the studies of news reception. So what did we do? We conducted 71 semi-structured interviews in three different cities of the U.S., during January and December 2017, and we recruited our participants following a snowball sampling technique, which led not to a percentage sample, but a pretty diverse set of participants. We analyzed our transcripts. Of course, everything that you read today is we're using pseudonyms. It's all anonymized. And we analyzed all the transcripts following a grounded theory approach. So what did we find? We organized our findings in two main sections. First, how are people making sense of a perceived changing media landscape in the U.S.? And how are they managing, how are they developing strategies, practices to counter the perceived misinformation and fake news in the media ecosystem? So first of all, participants across the ideological spectrum shared negative opinions about the media ecosystem. They felt that there was a lower quality of news reporting, usually tied to news reporting being perceived as very biased, or the news media is too polarized. And many times they tied these perceptions with their experience of news consumption during and after the 2016 election. As Eric said, for example, I wouldn't call it news. It's like MSNBC, you know? There's no news about it. It's just one side of the news. But even though participants had these negative opinions about the media ecosystem, they also indicated to trust the media they consume, signaling the presence of third-person effects. And this was mostly true for older people and those with higher levels of education. As for instance, Deborah said, "I worry about my kids in this crazy fake world they are growing up." Although many interviewees refer to social media as their gateway to news or their entry point to news, they were also very concerned about consumption of news on social media. And this was especially true among young people who also indicated to use social media the most. For instance, Mike said, "It's hard to decipher what's real and what's not. So, like, if I just see an article on Facebook, then I might go to the internet and try to find that same headline." Secondly, which are some of the practices and the strategies that people are trying to develop to manage the perceived misinformation? So participants indicating being more alert regarding news quality, many times indicating that they were disappointed by how the news media had informed them during the elections, during the 2016 U.S. elections. Some said that they felt that they had been in information echo chambers and that the news media were too biased, too polarized. Therefore, they indicated to develop strategies to build notions of objectivity themselves, of neutrality, things that they cannot find on the news media ecosystems. For instance, Elisa said, I see the different organizations and different publications having an obvious bias. I feel it's my duty to go get the facts and not take everything I read at face value. So others, similarly to Elisa, expressed, for instance, to feel more adept to counter the effects of perceived misinformation because of their own life experience, their knowledge about certain topics, and, of course, the credibility, the reputation of the sources. They would also frequently express that they would rely on repetition of a piece of information in multiple news media. So if they, for instance, Samantha said, typically if I see something on a site just popping up, I look at my sites. I mean, if more than one reputable site has it, then it's probably pretty good. So in order to establish if something is a fact, they rely on seeing that piece of information repeated in different news media. In order to counter a sense of a highly polarized news environment, they would also try to get a sense of objectivity and neutrality by triangulating information that comes from ideologically different or non-media sources. So, for instance, Kendra said, if I read something in a story and it sounds like they are exaggerating a fact just to make a point, I'll go on Google to find the real source. Interestingly, participants also indicated that even though they find reading news on social media as relatively untrustworthy, and they are very aware of this, they have certain contacts whom they define as sort of their credibility assessors when it comes to being informed about certain topics. So George said, it's not Facebook that I trust, it's my friends that I trust. So what is all this telling us? Overall, participants perceived news reporting to be too polarized and biased and were frustrated about the difficulty of finding objective or neutral news. They were also aware, mostly after the 2016 U.S. election, of possible echo chambers that they had been part of, and they indicated to try to develop practices to break through them. At the same time, they indicated to trust the media they choose to consume, which indicates the presence of third-person effects. Secondly, they also said that they rely on social media for news, although they do so with high levels of awareness and distrust. So in order to counter these perceptions of misinformation, they develop strategies and practices, such as seeking for repetition of information on different news sources in order to build an idea of what a fact is, or they triangulate information across ideologically different news sources in order to get to a sense of an objective or neutral reality. They indicated that these practices are part of their new rituals, their habits, their everyday habits that organize their news information practices. So what we see is that even though these are not habits and rituals that are organized on institutional dynamics, as it was earlier studied, they are organized by more interpersonal ones, and they are stable and part of their information routines. Finally, we found that participants relied on opinion leaders, but these were not media or opinion leaders in the public sphere. These were their personal contacts. They trust around different issues. These are acquaintances that become their credibility assessors. And in their accounts, that's one of the reasons why they are still reading news on social media, despite perceiving social media as a risky space to be consuming news. So So overall, our focus on these practices counter perceived misinformation from an MAIC perspective offers a more realistic account on the complexity of sense-making during news consumption, one that counters some of the mainstream narratives that suggest that people are completely disempowered in this new news media environment. On the contrary, we show that news consumers are smart, interpreting their needs, media ecosystems, and have high levels of agency and awareness when enacting practices of misinformation. So thank you.
Okay, it looks, yes, it does. So yes, let's get rolling. Good luck. Thank you.
Sorry about that. So thank you so much for the invitation, Oscar. Oscar invited me to talk a little bit about some of the ideas in a book I've got coming out this summer. Called Social Media and the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. So a lot of the ideas are specific to the U.S. context, given our idiosyncratic regulatory framework we have in this country, but I hope some of the ideas and arguments are still of interest. So I'll dive right in because I know you don't want me talking for too long. Obviously, not only globally, but it took quite a while in the U.S., I think, relatively speaking, to see the conversation around the possible need for a more robust regulatory framework for social media to really take off in earnest, but we're there now. Most important, of course, is that even Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook has even acknowledged and sort of been publicly advocating for some greater regulation. In the U.S. and probably other places as well, I mean, I think the concerns fall into two distinct silos. One is the user data silo, where there are concerns about privacy and security and control of our data. And then there is the content silo, where the concerns are around issues such as disinformation, hate speech, and violence. These tend to be treated, at least here in the U.S., they tend to be treated as separate issues, which I think is problematic. And in many ways, what I'm going to talk about today is an effort to try to connect these a bit more in a bit of a stronger way. But they do have obvious connections around concerns like filter bubbles and micro-targeting, which are all about the role that data plays in making sure that different types of customized messages and content reach particular audience segments. But in both cases also, they share the fact that the First Amendment acts as an impediment to a lot of potential regulatory interventions. On the content side, that's obvious. On the user data side, it's less obvious, though it's sort of, you know, if we look back at the intersection of privacy and free speech in the U.S., it gets to issues such as the, you know, any restrictions on how user data can be employed represent restrictions on who you can target with your messaging, and that can raise First Amendment concerns. So one thing I have to run through fairly quickly is this: that in the U.S. we have this distinction between regulatory motivations and regulatory rationales. Motivations are the reasons we regulate media, you know, the concerns we have about issues like diversity, et cetera, which I'll get into a bit more later. And but the rationales are the technologically specific justifications that we employ that allow us to impose regulations in pursuit of these particular goals. So these are the reasons why the First Amendment can be weaker in specific contexts and can allow for public interest-oriented goals to be pursued. So I'll illustrate with some examples. We have in the U.S. what we call the scarcity rationale. It has been applied to broadcasting. That's what's supposed to be represented by that little antenna. And it's been applied to satellites. light. And it is this idea that because the spectrum is uniquely scarce, that justifies government intervention in this space and has justified a whole range of different types of regulations that represent restrictions on the First Amendment rights of broadcasters, both, you know, terrestrial and satellite. What I'm going to talk about today a fair bit is the public resource rationale, which is something different but related, which is this idea that has been applied in broadcasting and satellite and also in cable television regulation, that certain types of media outlets are utilizing a publicly owned resource, whether it's spectrum or public rights of way, streets, sidewalks, etc., and that use of that public resource imposes a quid pro quo, and therefore these outlets must provide some sort of content that serves the public interest or abide by other public interest obligations in exchange for the use of this resource. Pervasiveness is a rationale that's been applied to broadcast television and cable, and there have been failed efforts to apply it to the internet, and this is the idea that a medium can be, quote, uniquely pervasive, that has a unique reach or impact potential that in turn justifies government regulation. Reasonably ancillary is one that's been applied to cable primarily, and it's this idea that one medium is sort of a key mechanism for the distribution of another, and therefore in the case of cable, a big part of the broadcast rationale regulatory framework has applied. So I go through these just primarily to illustrate that we have this model where the why we regulate, or the goals we have, and the justifications we have for pursuing those goals represent different things. And you need both, obviously. Now, it's generally been assumed that none of these really apply well to a context like social media. But the argument I've been working through a bit, and it's in the book a little bit, but more detailed in a paper that I'm working on now, is this idea that we can actually think about aggregate user data as a public resource like spectrum. Just as spectrum is owned by the people, and that's the line. Pretty well, that it's sort of a special kind of public resource. We can make a similar argument for spectrum, which is where I'm going to go next. And just as in the case of the spectrum, where public ownership has compelled public interest obligations, we could go in a similar direction if we think about user data in the aggregate. So, to me, this is a natural offshoot of the fact that property rights around user data have remained contested and remained ambiguous. People don't seem to be, content with sort of traditional notions of property in this space. So I'm putting user data as a public resource forward as a resolution to that. It's a reflection of the fact that data aggregation is increasingly central to how we actually define media organizations, which I'll get into later, and it allows for the transference of a traditional and established and relatively robust media regulatory rationale to translate to this new environment. It also builds upon, if some of you are familiar with the work around the idea that these platforms should be thought of as information fiduciaries and have special duties of care for our data, it builds upon and extends that proposal as well. Because it's one that, while it has been widely embraced, some critics have argued that it's inadequate and doesn't really capture the full scope of the concerns that need to be addressed. So, first important to know, there's this question about whether property rights exist in user data. Here's from some of the literature, some of the relevant concepts, you know, that this dichotomy of no property versus pure personal property rights doesn't really hold up, that it's a difficult sort of resource to define in terms of traditional property notions. Even the GDPR, while it grants a lot of what seem like property rights, the notion of property rights is never actually mentioned. So some people have argued that what we really have is this sort of quasi-property right in the realm of user data. And if it's this sort of quasi-property right, this is where I think the notion of user data as a public resource can come in and capture and sort of resolve this sort of ambiguity. Because, of course, the value resides in these massive aggregations of user data. Just so, and so it's in the collective that the value is resides, and it makes it comparable to Spectrum as a collective public resource. So we can think of both, essentially, both Spectrum and aggregate user data as a resource that's owned by the people. Our collective decision making is what has produced this value, and that can be seen as triggering this quid pro quo for usage. Usage of our public resource, usage of our aggregate user data to extract value could trigger a range of potential public interest obligations. These could be data related to data protections, or they could be content related, because public interest obligations have had a content related dimension in the U.S. for quite some time. The real issue here is, of course, how well do Spectrum and user data hold up if you compare them to each other? They're both central to the business models of the media entities at issue. Spectrum, obviously, is transmission-focused, whereas user data are more a product. And that necessarily raises the question, well, if we're going to treat user data, which is a product, as this public resource, shouldn't this apply to all ad-supported media that essentially monetize audience attention? And I would say that answer is no, because the traditional audience data that have served a product are very different from the user data that social media platforms aggregate in a number of key ways. First, we're dealing in census now when we're talking about aggregate user data, where traditional audience data represent a sample from a relatively small population who oftentimes has has to make a consent to take part and is even compensated. The scales are not comparable when we're talking about a census versus a sample, obviously. And in the user data context, we're missing the whole third-party data gathering and aggregation, the Nielsens, et cetera, that these intermediaries that serve as the aggregators and gatherers of data. Here we have a vertically integrated platform that essentially provides the audience data and provides the distribution platform and the content. Why is this migration appropriate? I think one of the key reasons is because it actually reflects the way our very definition of media organizations is changing. Here I rely on a recent piece by Joe Turow and Nick Caldry that I found really useful, recommended to everybody, as they emphasize that we need to think about media as a convergence of message circulating technologies with data extraction and analysis technologies. Essentially foregrounding audiences' role as resources for value extraction. I highlight that term resource because the very notion of how we define media today is one in which our audience data, our user data, are a central resource that they monetize. And I'm arguing that it's actually a public resource. What this does is take us beyond the information fiduciary proposal by Jack Balkin, who's a legal scholar here in the U.S. His idea is that we think about the traditional fiduciary, which is an organization or an entity that has this responsibility to protect data because they deal in information, not in money. So we think about lawyers, doctors, et cetera, traditionally, accountants as information fiduciaries. They have duties of care, that is to be competent, diligent in how they handle people's data, and a duty of loyalty, that is to keep their clients' interests in mind and act in their best interests. Now, what's been important here is that the information fiduciary proposal has been put forth as a rationale for greater regulatory oversight for social media platforms. It acknowledges that but it really focuses on user data as speech. So it does recognize lower levels of First Amendment protection given the nature of the information at issue. According to the information fiduciary approach, the speech that occurs is not public discourse. It actually leaves social media companies free to decide on issues of content and focuses purely on privacy and data sharing and things of that sort. Does not lead us, as they point out, to expect that Facebook has a duty to keep us from receiving links from our Facebook friends that are misleading or emotionally disturbing. Now, my approach, if we're thinking about user data as a public resource, actually goes beyond this perspective and argues that, yes, indeed, we could expect and impose responsibilities and duties on these platforms to protect us from disinformation, violence, hate speech, etc. All the same kind of obligations and protections that we have imposed upon broadcasters who utilize a similar public resource, in this case, Spectrum. So what I'm trying to argue here is that essentially this notion of user data as a public resource operates as a way to address the inability we've had so far to apply a traditional regulatory rationale to this context. And basically what it does then is gets at the question of not what should we do, what are the specific obligations that should be imposed, but why might it be doable? That is, why might it actually be defensible from a First Amendment standpoint? It offers a resolution to this unresolved question of the property status of user data by saying we should treat it as a public resource akin to Spectrum, and it addresses that question of whether content-based regulation of social media platforms is constitutional. If regulating content on the broadcast in the broadcast industry is constitutional on the basis of broadcasters' usage of this public resource, then you could make a similar argument in the case of social media platforms and their use of aggregate user data. And in that way, it sort of ties both of these silos together in terms of the concerns we have about user data from a policy standpoint and the concerns we have about content from a policy standpoint. So I will stop there. Thank you. I understand the way this works is you guys now get to tweet away with how crazy this idea is.